for a possible measure introduction. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. LC 1653 relating to health care, sponsored by the Committee on the Judiciary. The members will recall last Thursday this was proposed. There was a question about whether or not this was a new relating clause or whether a new relating clause had to be drafted. And I double-checked, I should say Mr. Taylor double-checked with Legislative Council and confirmed that this is the new relating clause for this LC draft.
Okay, do I hear a motion?
Madam Chair, I move LC 1653 be submitted as a committee bill.
Senator Starr has moved that LC 1653 be submitted as a Judiciary Committee bill. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Our friends in the audience, the agenda has changed a little bit today. We're down to two bills, probably a good thing because one of them seems to be getting a lot of excitement here. So we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 182, and we will begin with a description by council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 182 would require individuals confined in correctional facilities, the Department of Corrections, to exhaust any administrative remedies before being permitted to file certain civil rights actions in state court.
Thank you. We will start with Terry Leggett, who is Marion County Circuit Court Judge. And you had said that Craig Berkman was here as well. Oh, Craig Prince.
I'm sorry. I said
Craig.
I was kind of wondering about that, Your Honor, but I didn't want to say anything. So welcome to the committee for both of you.
Thank you. Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I just wanted to come up with Judge Leggett and just give you the background of Senate Bill 182 as far as where it sits with the governor's review process. The governor set a review process to look at the criminal justice system, and one of the task forces that was set up with that was the Criminal Justice Systems Task Force. The other ones were an Adult Sentencing Task Force, a Meth Task Force, an Elder Abuse Task Force, and a Juvenile Justice Summit. And as a aside, I'm putting together the packet of that information of all the recommendations from those different task forces. It's at the printers now, and you'll have that, I hope, next week. At any rate, this Senate Bill 182 came to, from that task force, the Criminal Justice Systems Task Force, which Judge Leggett was a part of. It was then approved by the steering committee. So there was a steering committee that took all of these recommendations from the different task forces, and then it's been approved by the governor's office. So I'm here to support Senate 182, and I'm going to hand off to Judge Leggett because she was more intimately involved with it.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I was a member of that subcommittee on adjudications, and one of several things we were looking at were ways that we could streamline or have some efficiencies in the system. And this is just one of a few minor things that came out of that committee.
If you could identify yourself for our record.
Thank you. My name is Terry Leggett. I'm a circuit court judge here in Marion County and have been for 10 years. And Marion County, just so you know, gets a lot of inmate litigation, so we're intimately aware of inmate litigation probably more than we want to be in a lot of respects. But in any event, 1983 actions are, in the federal system, there's a requirement that before you can file a 1983 action, they have to exhaust their administrative remedies. So all we're doing with this bill is having the state law be in parity with the federal law. And the reason that becomes important is if our law is different, then there's forum shopping. And what forum shopping means is they pick the place where they think they have the best odds depending on the law. And I don't see any reason why we shouldn't require, I mean, the inmate shouldn't be required in all instances to go to the administrative process first before we come to the state circuit courts. The circuit courts process is more formalized for good reason. There's the rules that apply are stricter, and for all the litigants, it creates more, it's more costly. If you're filing something in circuit court, you have to have a lawyer, follow all the rules, and mainly in these cases, the Attorney General's office, they're going to speak later, other people that appear in our court on these. But to to avoid forum shopping and to make, what I was thinking was it would also take some of the litigation out of the state courts and leave it administratively, because hopefully in the administrative process, if there is a problem, it can be dealt with in the administrative process, and it would never get to the circuit courts. So it should save money and time in our courts, and that was the purpose of the proposal.
Thank you. And forgive me for missing this, but you said that other states require this?
The federal government does.
The federal government does.
Right. In any 1983 action filed in federal court, they have to exhaust their administrative remedies. Since the state doesn't do that, they come directly to the state court because they don't have to exhaust here.
Right. Okay. Are there questions? Senator Ringo.
Thank you. Could you describe what those administrative remedies are and how that works?
Well, I'm not an administrative judge and don't handle those, but I'm going to ask my colleagues at the AG's office, and I think also the superintendent's going to speak. But essentially, the inmate files a grievance about some thing that they think's a problem that's affecting their rights, which is under 1983, it's your rights, constitutional rights. That goes to a hearings officer, and the matter then is litigated at that in that process, and decisions made about whether or not there needs to be changes. But it's much more informal. There isn't a formal pleading filed, a formal response, that sort of thing.
Madam Chair, I guess I'd like to know more about that, but if you're telling me to wait for subsequent witnesses, I'd be happy to do that.
They'll be coming up next.
Right. Okay, thank you.
And thank you, Senator Ringo and Chair Burdick. I just I'm in a kind of a hurry to get back to my court because they're waiting for me, but I think, and if there are further questions about that after you hear the other testimony, I'll be happy to do some more research for you.
Thank you. I do.
Senator Przanski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Judge Leggett, it may be not for you, but I guess I want to get this out because my concern is the check and balances, because we are, in fact, actually, from what I understand, the process for an administrative procedure is there's timelines for the complaint to be filed, for the state to get back to that individual as to whether they think it's through the administrative process has merit or not. But then there's an appeal process that also can actually go into a very long period of time. In fact, I don't think there's any deadline for when those appeals actually have to be handled. And as you can imagine, if you have a case such as what I understand the state went through on hepatitis C, if someone thinks they're not getting the medical attention, they could be there for years before, in my understanding, some of those appeals may in fact actually run. So I guess the question is, what is there going to be, or is there any check and balance to make certain that the state is following through with its obligation in on any type of appellate proceeding that would be within the administrative procedure? And then I have one other question besides that, and this would be basically whether the state is able to actually, through the state court proceedings, limit federal statutes or, you know, complaints about them not being complied within a state area, such as the ADA or any other type of tort claim. I understand that they may have a relief through the federal system, but if the federal system already says you can't enter the system until you exhaust all of your administrative remedies, aren't we basically putting people in a situation where they may never get relief because the process never moves forward?
Chair Senator Przanski, first of all, to say that it's faster than the circuit court system is not true, because the same procedural issues that apply, maybe even more so, happen in our courts in terms of depositions needing to be taken and things moving slowly. I have a case that I think is at least 2 years old, maybe older, that's a 1983 case that's about 3 feet thick right now. And our appellate courts suffer from at least the same problem. There's no timeline on our appellate courts either if it comes from me to them. You know, if I deny it and it goes to our appellate courts, it's the same process. It's got to be at least as slow in that formality. And then they may go to federal court, too, from there. I don't know the issue that you've raised regarding the appellate process and things getting tied up in there. I'm just going to defer to the Attorney General's office, who actually handles those, so I can't answer that question. Sorry.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Back to court.
See you in a moment.
Okay, I think we'll take Leonard Williamson from the Department of Justice and Mary Botkin. Maybe you could come up here together. Thank you.
Good Madam Chair, Leonard Williamson from the Department of Justice. I handle inmate civil litigation there.
Excuse me. I'm sorry, Madam Chair, I didn't hear the name.
Leonard Williamson.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I'm here to give some testimony in favor of Senate Bill 182. My primary assignment within the Department of Justice is to defend the Department of Corrections against civil suits brought in both state and federal court. Over the last 4+ years, in reviewing what the federal courts are doing, they are dismissing cases in which inmates have not pursued their grievance remedies when those are available within the institutional setting.
Mr. Williamson, could you speak up just a little bit?
Sure. I'll speak a little
Thank
bit
you very much.
More directing the microphone. In those circumstances in which the court has made a determination at the front end that an inmate has not pursued their grievance remedies, the matter is dismissed without prejudice so that the inmate has an opportunity to go back to the grievance system, pursue their grievances till conclusion. If they don't find a remedy there, then they can go back to federal court and refile. This has been a law with respect to federal litigation since 1995, but it wasn't until the mid-2001 when the United States Supreme Court decided a case called Booth versus Turner, and a year later a case titled Porter versus Nassau, in which the court definitively defined that when they mean exhaustion of remedies, they mean all remedies must be exhausted no matter what type of claim it is, whether it's a medical claim or an assault claim. The district courts here in Oregon since then, the federal district courts, have routinely asked inmates at the front end whether or not they've pursued their grievance remedies before filing. Oftentimes we find during our investigation that maybe 40% of the time those inmates have not completed the grievance process, and the district court, as I have indicated, would dismiss those claims and allow them to refile later on after they've completed the grievance process. I have seen on occasion where the grievance system has remedied the particular complaint that the inmate has brought. So it does have a positive side to it in that it tends to pare down certain litigation. It also has a positive side to it in that those claims tend to be more fully investigated at the agency level when there's a grievance filed, because now they've got somebody else's attention and the administrators are asking for those investigations to occur. And finally, by not having a process in state court that limits claims to those who have been put through the grievance system, it does encourage inmates to forum shop and go into state court when they know they can't get into federal court. And that would be the conclusion of my testimony. If you have questions, I remain available for those.
Thank you. Maybe we could take questions on Senator Ringo.
I will circle. Okay.
Thank you very much. Thanks for testifying today. Could you describe the grievance process and I guess really try to explain the words in this bill, which says all available administrative remedies. I'd like to know what all available administrative remedies includes.
Well, I would categorize them in four different categories. One, when an inmate receives discipline for an act, they can appeal the disciplinary sanction itself. And there ends up being, I think, three levels to that process once a hearings officer has heard the disciplinary matter. At those hearings, inmates can put on evidence and ask to call witnesses and give testimony for themselves. If they disagree with the hearings officer, they can then appeal to the superintendent, who will then conduct a review of the testimony given as well as all the exhibits. If the superintendent then affirms the hearings officer and the inmate still objects, the inmate can go on to what's called a third level of appeal to the assistant director of institutions, who will then conduct a similar review. That would be considered a matter that would then be exhausted at that level. Now, there's a separate grievance process matters that involve race discrimination within the institution. There's a separate person within each institution that investigates those types of complaints by my inmates, and an inmate has up to a year to file or to seek redress through that process. And there are similar levels then of review if the inmate doesn't agree with the person who's conducting that investigation. Then, for medical claims, an inmate can file a grievance. For example, if a doctor has decided not to provide them a hernia belt or something like that. There's an internal committee called the Therapeutic Level of Care Committee. It's made up of a number of different doctors within the Department of Correction, as well as the chief medical officer for the Department of Corrections. They would then sit down and review that request. And if there's a good medical reason to give that person the item they're seeking, then they would. If there isn't a good medical reason, it would be denied. And that decision that comes out of that committee can then be reviewed by the director.
Excuse me for interrupting, but is there a timeline associated on some of these medical appeals processes?
Grievances with respect to, for example, conditions of confinement or, for example, you denied me a hernia belt, those would have a period, I believe, under the rules of 30 days for the inmate to file the initial grievance. However, in a situation where you're talking about an ongoing violation, for example, hepatitis, that you're not receiving treatment for hepatitis medication, those would be ongoing, continuing violations versus a one-time situation where you've denied a prosthetic device. Ongoing violations, you know, every time you've made a request for treatment of those circumstances would trigger another 30-day period. Does that answer the chair's question?
Yeah, it does, but then there's a period for filing the grievance, then there's a period for responding to the grievance, and what is that time period?
You know, off the top of my head, I don't recall what that is. Mr. Zerniak is here from the Department of Corrections, and he may have that specific recollection. They recently changed the administrative rules a year or so ago at our urging, because an inmate only had a 5-day window of opportunity to file a grievance in response to a violation.
Okay.
So I don't know on the appeal end of that how many days there's a required response to, but I know there is one under the rules. I just don't recall what it is off the top of my head.
Go ahead, sorry for the interruption.
Thank you. That helped clarify things. But you said there were four type of administrative remedies, and you were ticking down them, and I'm not sure.
The final one would be any situation in which an inmate feels that an officer has somehow violated their rights. And that's just a grievance. They just file a grievance. And they've got 30 days to file that grievance. And then there's a response. And again, I'm sorry for not having the timeline specifically in my memory here. But then those would go up to the superintendent level as well as the assistant director's level.
Okay. Just follow up.
Are
there one or two or three examples of the most common types of grievances that are at issue here? What's a typical example of a grievance you would rather keep out of the court system and first handle?
Well, the ones that I see are typical aren't the ones that would be typical within the institution. For example, an inmate's complaining that their Muslim diet has been interfered with, and that inmate workers on the line that are preparing those food items aren't using sanitary methods. That might be a grievance in the arena of religious values for that inmate. So that grievance would be investigated and make a determination of whether or not the inmates are using proper hygiene while they're preparing the food.
Okay. Chair, follow up. Do you have any figures on how many of such lawsuits are filed, prisoner Section 1983 claims? To the state courts?
I can't tell you off the top of my head how many filed in state court. We have much more filings of civil rights litigation in federal court than we do in state
court. Right, but this wouldn't impact federal court?
No.
So, Madam Chair, just a thought. I'm just wondering if you can give us some indication of the scope of the problem here.
Well, recently I had a piece of litigation involving an inmate by the name of Alvin Cannell. Mr. Cannell is a very frequent litigator. Filed an action in Nyan County back in early 2001. After conducting a short investigation, it was clear that none of the claims raised in the complaint had he pursued any kind of grievance remedy at all. That piece of litigation, we're on our fifth motion to dismiss, is still pending as of last week. And had the court had this particular mechanism in place, he would have already had the case dismissed. He would have been able to go back to the institution, pursue his grievance remedy to some end, and then refile the claim properly. Does that answer your question?
Well, it doesn't help me understand the scope of how many lawsuits are involved that you're trying to address here. But in that example you just gave me, in your opinion, it was a meritless claim.
Yes.
But if the inmate was persistent, I mean, fine, he'll satisfy the administrative hurdles, and then he'll file the same meritless claim in the court. Isn't that right? You're just going to slow him down a little bit.
It may slow him down a little bit, but in other circumstances, though, the inmate has been able to get relief through the grievance system. There are some instances where it gets up to the director's level, and the director overrules line staff and says, no, we're going to do X for this inmate. That case never makes it in the court.
Uh-huh.
Well, maybe we've got someone from the Department of Corrections coming up. In fact, Mr. Chernick, why don't you come and join this panel if you're out? Oh, no, you can stay.
We got three chairs.
I think this is you're a good panel here for consideration of this issue. Because I suspect there might be some statistics to answer some of your questions, Senator Ringo. Are there other questions of this witness, Senator Kozanski?
Yeah, I guess I want to follow up where Senator Ringo started off, and that's really this whole process of how the administrative procedure. What I'm hearing right now is that before an inmate can go into the federal system, they have to basically exhaust all of their administrative grievance possibilities or process.
Right.
We don't have that in the state level at this point.
No.
And if we require that at the, before they get into the state level, once they've completed whatever that duration is, then they are going to have the right to go into either of the two court systems. Is that correct?
Yes.
So I guess I want to get back to the point because I was jotting down the notes on the different types of what I call grievances, not really grievance process that is used. And the only one that I could get most of the stuff down was the very first one. But it sounds to me that an inmate can grieve any action by the department, be it a sanction that has been administered to them or if they've been denied medical care. It then goes to an appeal if they grieve it, and if it goes against them through the administrative law judge, I guess, is who's overseeing that. Then it goes to an appeal to the superintendent. Is that correct?
Point of clarification, Madam Chair, for Senator Prudansky, the only time there is a hearings officer who may be an administrative law judge involved in any of the four scenarios that I outlined is when the inmate is in front of a hearings officer for discipline.
Okay.
At the other three types of examples I provided, there is not.
So when they file whatever complaint, let's using the medical claim, denied some type of use, and what I hear, there's really two types there, one for lack of medication, or another one for an ongoing, long-term
illness, or some other.
So who do they file their complaint with?
That form of a grievance would either go to the treating physician to respond to, or what's called a therapeutic level of care committee, which is within the Department of Corrections, supervised by Dr. Shelton. And that particular little committee is made up of four or five doctors, maybe a nurse, to review the chart and the request.
Okay, so just using that last example.
Yeah.
The treating physician, that would be someone that's either inside the institution providing the treatment or for some reason an outside physician has been called in, he or she, to...
That's correct.
And if it's not an outside physician, then it's going to be who oversees it within the institution?
That would be... I can't think of Dr. Shelton's title. He's here today.
All right. So Dr. Shelton?
The director?
Is that
director, medical director?
Okay, so the medical director is Dr. Shelton.
Yes.
And what I'm hearing is that if there's an issue there, the inmate then could go to the therapeutic care committee, which includes Dr. Shelton.
Yes.
Who else is on that committee? Because, I mean,
it may be four or five doctors from each one of the institutions.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe one of the nursing staff. And they will review the inmate's chart and review the request made by the inmate.
And they're all within the Department of Corrections, all of these individuals?
Yes.
And the person that's originally made the decision is someone within the institution?
Yes.
Okay. Then where does it go if the therapeutic care committee denies the relief that the inmate's looking?
My reading of the current grievance rules would then be that it would go from the TLC committee to the director level.
All right. And the director level would be at the institution that the individual's at, or what?
It would be either the director for the institution's, be it Max Williams, or the assistant director or deputy director, Mitch Morrow, or Mr. Zerniak.
Okay. And then from the director's level, if they say that, again, the inmate is turned down or denied whatever that relief they're looking for, where would it go next? Or is that
they could then file in court.
All right. Could someone please tell us what the time frame would be for those type of claims? Because what I understand, there is no directive or requirement from when it gets to the, let's call it the appeals level, so in this case to the director's or director's office, for a time for the state to respond to that appeal of that grievance or denial of that grievance.
Senator Prasansky, this might be a good segue into Mr. Cherniak's testimony.
Really great.
I think some of these answers lie in your area of jurisdiction. So are there final questions of this witnesses? And Mary, if you would bear, Ms. Butkin, if you would bear with us to take this one. So
I'm fine. I just wondered if you wanted the medical director up here.
Well, you just seem very anxious to leave the podium. So if you
would make me stay, are you?
That would make you more comfortable. You are more than welcome. This is not a hostage situation. Yet. Okay, thank you. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Cherniak.
Chair Berger, thank you, and members of the committee. I am Stan Zerniak, Assistant Director for the Oregon Department of Corrections, actually Assistant Director of Operations. And I'm here to provide some information on behalf of the department's support of Senate Bill 182. In regards to the inmate grievance procedure, let me try to kind of outline that for you. If I can, I'm certainly not going to read the whole procedure, but I have highlighted a couple of key provisions I think that the committee would find of interest. The first thing I think that the committee would be beneficial to understand is that our grievance procedure really has kind of two components to it. The first is more of an informal type of a process where we encourage inmates to meet with the staff member who they have a grievance against to try to work the grievance out verbally prior to going to the formalized process. Another component of that process, unless it's an emergency grievance, and they can waive that part of it. The other part of that is if they can't resolve the issue by a verbal conversation, then it's encouraged that they go to the that they actually do a written correspondence to the staff member and try to resolve it through that process. Now that component of the process, the staff member has 5 days to resolve, and that's not really a hard and fast 5 days because we have to take into account days off, employees being on vacation, and things like that. The safeguard in the whole process, I think, comes when we're within 30 days of the actual issue, whatever it is that the inmate is aggrieved about. He can then go through the formal process, which is to file a formal grievance in writing to our grievance coordinator. Each institution has an assigned grievance coordinator. And I'm going to go ahead and if if the court will, excuse me, slip of the tongue. I'd like to go ahead and review some of the key provisions when it becomes a formalized grievance. First component is, upon receiving an inmate grievance, the grievance coordinator will assign a grievance a number and record its receipt by the inmate grievance log. After the inmate grievance has been logged, the grievance coordinator will send a grievance receipt to the inmate and send the grievance and a grievance response form to the staff respondent. And that usually is the supervisor of the person whoever is being grieved. Respondent will complete the form and submit it to his or her supervisor for review and signature. Every effort shall be made to return the response to the grievance coordinator for processing within 15 days. The second piece is actually an appeal to that if the inmate is not satisfied with the response that he gets at that level. Appeal timeliness. An appeal must be received by the grievance coordinator within 14 days of the date the employee's response was sent to the inmate. The functioning unit manager shall respond to the inmate's grievance within 30 calendar days. Now, a functioning unit manager at most of our units is the superintendent of the institution, the chief administrative officer of that institution. Then there's an additional level of appeal. An appeal must be received by the grievance coordinator within 14 days of the coordinator's return date to the inmate. The assistant director, and that's in my case, for anything that has to do with institutional operations, it will come to me, shall respond to the inmate's grievance within 30 days of receipt of the appeal. The assistant director's decision of an inmate's grievance appeal is final and not subject to further review. So that would satisfy, once it gets to my level, that would satisfy our formalized grievance procedure. And I can tell the committee that I get very few of those, because most, by far the largest number and percentage of inmate grievances are resolved at a much lower level than to come to my level. I probably get, I would say on a really busy month, maybe 3 or 4 out of our whole system of 12,000 inmates. So it's not really that many. I will also tell the committee that if an inmate went through every step of the process and if every timeline went as far out as it could go, that we would end up with about a 4.5 month time period to resolve an inmate's grievance. That's not a hard and fast number, because again, we have to account for the fact that sometimes key people that are involved in the grievance process may not be available. So it can go farther than that. Very, very rare that it even gets that far.
Does that include acute medical issues?
Is there a special provision
for acute medical issues?
Chair Burdick, acute medical issues would go to Dr. Shelton, and Dr. Shelton would review that through the process that Mr. Leonardson reviewed.
Okay, so what would the timeline on that one? Maybe he needs to speak to that later, but what would be the maximum? You said 4.5 months for the ones that you talked about. I'm very interested in finding out what the maximum for a medical claim would be.
Sure, but
maybe we can wait for him to.
Sure, but I probably would have to ask Dr. Shelton that, since he really has that part of the process.
Okay, well, maybe we can do that after you all are finished. Are there questions? Are you done with your testimony?
Sure, Rick. Just a couple comments I wanted to make, if I might. I think the bill itself has been pretty well reviewed, so I won't go through all that part of my testimony. But I will say that the department does not seek to deny inmates access to the courts for redress of legitimate claims regarding prison conditions. Rather, the department supports Senate Bill 182 because it is good public policy, especially in a time of critically limited state resources. Under this bill, the state courts will remain open and available to inmates that first seek but fail to satisfactorily resolve their disputes within the department or its employees or through the department's internal grievance process. I would also like to make the committee aware that the department has a parallel inmate claims exhaustion bill that is presently before the House Judiciary Criminal Law Subcommittee, House Bill 2143. As a result of drafting by legislative counsel, the bill is broader in scope than the department originally proposed. Consequently, the department intends to offer a friendly amendment to the bill to narrow the bill's scope to address just two issues. One issue is ensuring that inmates are required to first exhaust their available administrative remedies before filing small claims court claims. and limiting damages recoverable by the inmate for lost or damaged property to the actual value of the lost or damaged property. And that completes my testimony, and I'll be glad to answer any other questions.
When you talk about an amendment to narrow the scope, you're talking about an amendment to House Bill 2143, not this one. Is that correct?
No, Chair Burry, that is correct.
Okay, thank you. Other questions? Thank you. Now it's your turn, Ms. Botkin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mary Botkin, and I'm here this afternoon representing the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, and we represent the officers and staff who work within the Department of Corrections system. I'm going to focus my testimony on just sort of one narrow part of this. Last session, we actually introduced a bill very similar to this to require that inmates exhaust administrative remedies before filing with medical licensure boards. And the reason that we introduced that bill was because we had a situation where inmates were filing complaints with the dental licensing board against the dentists at the institution because they weren't getting what they considered to be the level of care that they thought they should get, and the level of care was not meeting the, quote, community standards as established by the Dental Licensing Board. The realities of our lives in the institution was that in the budget process, our budget had been reduced for dental care to the level that inmates were only getting treatment for acute pain related to tooth decay or lack of care. And one inmate filed a claim against the one of our dentists because he did not get a gold tooth but rather got a porcelain tooth and felt that he should have had a gold tooth as other inmates in the past had gotten. You know, it sort of sounds frivolous until you understand that the dental board filed formal charges against the dentist for not meeting the community of care standard, and his license was up for review for almost a year. And so we had one of our dentists who was actually practicing his trade there in the prison while his license was being reviewed by the dental board. And we have an extensive file in our office of efforts to resolve the issue with the Board of Dentistry on behalf of our dentist that went unanswered. And it was not until we introduced legislation that eliminated their ability to oversee the practice inside the institutions that they finally responded and resolved the issue to the favor of the dentist. And he is still practicing. In fact, now I think he's actually out of the bargaining unit in a management position. But be that as it may, that is what brought this to our attention. Once that was brought to our attention, then we started looking at other issues and found that in some cases, inmates will use the disciplinary grievance process as a way to harass officers that run a housing unit maybe stricter than other officers do. You know, there's not much that happens to the officer as long as they're doing things according to the protocols as established by the institution. But it is a harassment tool, and, you know, oftentimes the inmates will pursue as far as they can, including small claims court cases and other things, just as a way to harass the officers. We don't think that it's good policy to stop the inmate's grievance process. Let me be clear about that. What we think is a good process is to say, this is the grievance process. You go through the grievance process and we resolve it at the lowest level possible, and if we can't, then you have the right to, once you've exhausted all your administrative procedures, to go on from there. What we found was that inmates weren't doing that, and this bill just sort of makes it clear that they have to exhaust all their administrative processes. And I think that, you know, if Dr. Shelton comes up here, I know that when we were in the House, he was very articulate about talking about acute mental or medical needs that inmates may have. And, you know, we try to do what we can within budget constraints and within staffing constraints. It is not a good environment for any officer or staff person to, quote, pick on the inmates. There's more of them than there are of us. And, you know, picking random fights is not something that anybody does regularly, or if they do, they don't last long. So, you know, this is just a good policy bill that says, you know, follow the rules, go through the process, and if you don't get what you want, there's a way to go out to seek outside counsel and outside remedies. And, you know, where there is a life-threatening medical issue at hand, certainly the process moves much more quickly, and Dr. Shelton can talk about that much more articulately than I can.
Thank you. Questions? If Mr. Cherniak, if you would just stand by, we're going to hear a little bit from the opposition on this, and then I'd like to bring you and Dr. Shelton back after the opponents speak their mind, if you would be willing to stay.
Will do, Chair Burdick.
Andrea Meyer and Jeff Sugarman.
Good afternoon, Chair Burdick, members of the Senate Committee. Andrea Meyer, for those of you who haven't met me, I'm the Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon. The ACLU opposes Senate Bill 182. This proposal intends to replicate...
You're fine.
God, I'm really getting good mic feedback today. This intends to replicate the exhaustion requirements that have been set forth in the Federal Prison Litigation Reform Act, PLRA. One of the main purposes of the PLRA was to get federal courts out of running state prisons and local jails. The legislative history is clear under this that it applied only to claims brought under federal law. It was never intended to limit prisoner access to remedies in state courts. Just as the ACLU opposes the PLRA, we strongly oppose this attempt to replicate a part of it into state law. The exhaustion requirement under this bill, just like the federal requirement, puts insurmountable barriers in place to inmates who have plainly meritorious claims and are seeking redress of fundamental rights. The result of the federal law has been that prisoners fail to exhaust due to ignorance, mental illness, disability, and being misled by prison staff. They are then forever barred from filing meritorious claims. The very same thing can and will happen here if this law is passed. I'm submitting with my testimony a summary of examples of the results of the PLRA, as well as our top 10 of non-frivolous lawsuits filed by prisoners across the country. I don't believe there are any Oregon cases that I'm bringing forward to you today. But I believe that Mr. Sugarman will be able to address more of the local issues going on. One of the first problems is the very structure of the exhaustion requirement allows prisoners' access to courts to be manipulated by the very people the prisoner is trying to sue. Thus, for example, a prisoner jail can have as many steps in its grievance process as it wants. It can also make the filing deadlines as short as it wants. And if, as was discussed here earlier, I mean, if the inmate can't, and isn't able to or doesn't satisfy those short timelines for filing the administrative remedy or grievance, that's it. They can never go to court because they fail to exhaust the administrative remedies. In one ACLU prison project, after the inmate successfully went through this, at that time, three-stage grievance process, the prison simply changed it to seven steps. In Oregon, Department of Corrections is not required to respond within a specific time period, but rather to make reasonable attempts to respond to a complaint. To leave the ability to seek redress in courts to the discretion of rules established by state as well as local corrections facilities, because this bill doesn't just include the state EOC, but also jails and juvenile facilities. It removes a fundamental right of inmates to access courts to seek relief from illegal and egregious violations of laws. Senate Bill 182 is an obvious incentive for prison and jail officials to change their grievance processes to make them as complex and difficult as possible, since it will reduce the possibility that they will get sued. The bill also allows the prison to usurp the power of the legislature by establishing short filing deadlines for the grievance system that effectively changes the statute of limitations for claims that under regular law, Oregon law, might be 1 or 2 years. But this could change it to limit it to 14 days, 7 days, or even 48 hours by virtue of requiring administrative action. By sitting on a grievance, the prison or jail officials can simply run out the statute of limitations. We believe, in addition to the policy issues at play that I discussed, this proposal raises constitutional concerns under the Oregon Bill of Rights. Article 1, Section 10 states, in part, that every man shall have remedy by due course of law for the injury done him in her person. I managed to change the gender on that as I wrote it out, so it will be inclusive. I think it's their person, property, and reputation. And Article 1, Section 20 states that no law shall be passed granting to any citizen or class of citizens privileges or immunities which upon the same terms shall not equally belong to all citizens. We believe Senate Bill 182 implicates those constitutional protections. Now, I believe that Oregon is different from a lot of other jurisdictions across the country, but the way that we ensure that we are better than most is to keep the necessary checks and balances between the various branches of government that the current law provides. We urge you not to go forward with this proposal. If I may, I just have a few comments based on some of the testimony. Earlier there was testimony that this is good because it allows, if you file an administrative complaint, it allows in some cases the department to take actions to remedy a problem. That ability still exists when someone files in court. And that's actually how you can make the lawsuit go away. So by allowing someone to file in court, this never precludes the department from fixing a problem that is so blatant that they agree it should be fixed. Thank you.
Thank you. Are you aware of other states that have taken this up? When we all talk about the federal law, but have other states taken similar actions to this?
I am aware that there are other states that have it. I can't give you a list of what won Senator Burdick right now. And I'd be happy simply to request that information from my national, and we might have a better overview. A number of states have proceeded with this, and we have opposed all of them for the reasons I've asserted.
Well, I'd be interested in that, and also in, because you raised some very legitimate concerns, and I'm just wondering if some of the other states have found a way to address those, maybe not to your satisfaction, but whether they have dealt with some of these issues.
I'll be happy to look into that, Senator Burdick, and get you a sense of what states have done. I think, as you can see from the examples of litigation and lawsuits that I filed, it's tough luck for a lot of inmates these days.
Correct. Thank you. Are there other questions, Senator Walker?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Meyer, I was reading your testimony on the bottom of the first page where you said that the bill would allow prison officials to usurp the power of the legislature and shorten up timelines. How do you know that?
Senator Burdick, Senator Walker, if an inmate has 14 days to file an action, a grievance, and if they fail to do that, if it's not an ongoing, I mean, in your testimony, if it's an ongoing problem, they could file, and they've got 30 days to file a grievance because it's an ongoing, and each time the incident happens, right? But do you recall the testimony that I believe it, one of the folks testified that there's 14 days when he was going through, I believe it was the Department of Justice lawyer, 14 days to file on the front end with some of these, and it's in the rules. If 20 days, and the inmate is unable for many reasons to do that, and it's 30 days that's elapsed since the incident or the problem occurred, they're barred from filing the grievance. They are barred because it's too late. If they cannot file the grievance, they, under this law, they would not be able to go to court, because they have not exhausted their administrative remedies.
I see. Okay.
Am I making it clear?
Yeah, kind of, sort of. I think I may need the department to clarify that for me.
Right. So if you have an injury normally where you could have a year before a car accident, something you have a year before you mm-hmm. file, because you can just go directly to court.
Right.
But the reason they're doing this is they want, it would bar inmates if it's a 30-day timeline, and these rules can be changed at any time. Right now, I think some of them are 14 days for an inmate to file if there's a problem, there's an injury. something's happened to their person or their property. And if they are medically unable to, they can't read and understand that they have to do that, and 3 to 2 months goes by before they can access the grievance process.
I see. Madam Chair?
Oh, oops,
thank you. So, Ms. Meyer, you're saying there's a different statute of limitations under administrative rule rather than statutory law for these inmates who want to process a claim, and if they don't file under the administrative procedure, they're forever barred from exercising their statutory rights in court.
Senator Burdick, yes, Senator Walker, yes. If it would allow the Department of Corrections through its own rulemaking can establish what the timeline is, and that could be, and is very different than what this legislature as a policy has decided people have to bring forward claims. Civil claim, yeah.
Is that it?
Yeah, Madam Chair, that kind of sums it all up. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Other questions from the committee? Thank you. Mr. Sugarman.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Sugarman. I am a lobbyist for the Western Prison Project and also a resident of Silverton, making me one of Senator Byer's constituents. Last week, we did testify in front of the House Judiciary Committee in opposition to the two House bills that were referred to earlier. We see this as a very similar bill, and it raises three major concerns in our minds. One is that there are very loose time limits set on the DOC to respond to grievances. According to Oregon Administrative Rule OAR 291-109-005 through 0060, a prisoner must make the grievance within 30 days. The DOC must make every effort to respond within 15 days. And under the appeals procedures that were outlined before, I could find no set hard time limits for the DOC to respond. If we're going to require people to exhaust all administrative remedies before going to court or to a medical board, as one of the House bills calls for, we should have strict timelines and required responses on both sides of the equation. As Ms. Meyer said, our second concern is the constitutional question. Although one of the DOJ lawyers I talked to earlier disagrees, our legal advisors tell us that states do not have the power to add procedural barriers to access federal rights or use federal statutes, even in state court. So there may be some serious constitutional questions with this measure. And finally, we've seen no evidence of serious problems with frivolous lawsuits or grievances. A couple of anecdotal stories, but no hard numbers on how many cases have been filed, how many grievances are filed. So it's unclear to us that this is a serious matter that needs addressing. In fact, one of the more recent court cases was a class action suit by people in prison over non-treatment of hepatitis C. In that case, Judge Brown found a pattern and a policy in previous ODOC administrations to delay and deny essential medical care for hepatitis C. And this finding has been replicated in several other distinct cases involving cancer, broken bones, hemophilia, and other serious medical conditions. Had these people in prison not had access to the courts, they would have had no mechanism for challenging this states in action for treating very serious diseases. And I guess my final concern is that I heard Judge Leggett say that we're trying to replicate a federal administrative remedy over state law here. And all of these internal grievance procedures that we talked about with the Department of Corrections are all internal. There are not hearing officers. There are not formal administrative procedures. And so, as Ms. Meyer said, the potential for delaying cases, delaying grievances is very great and could put people at risk. So we would urge the committee to reject these bills today. Thank you. Or this bill today. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there questions? Our council actually had a clarification on this bill.
I do. Madam Chair, thank you, members of the committee. Something Ms. Meyer said indicated to me that I misspoke when I gave you my verbal summary in the beginning of this public hearing. I believe I indicated that this bill would apply to inmates within the Department of Corrections, and that is incorrect. The term correctional facility within the bill makes it very clear. It's defined by a cross-reference statute, and it makes it clear that this would apply to persons who are confined in correctional facilities, which includes county correctional facilities, state correctional facilities. It also includes individuals confined who are found to be within the jurisdiction of the juvenile court, which means that they would apply. It would apply to juvenile correctional facilities as well. It would also apply to the state hospital, but only as to persons who are detained therein, having been charged or convicted of a crime, or having been found guilty except for insanity. So that definition is much broader than I inadvertently led you to believe, as Ms. Meyer pointed out. I wanted to correct that for the record.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Now maybe we could bring back Mr. Cherniak, and if he's willing, Dr. Shelton, maybe to answer some of the medically related questions that came up. Welcome back.
Chair Burdick and members of the committee, I'd also like to have Jeff M. Falkenberg, our general counsel from the AG's office, up here if we could.
That would be wonderful. Thank you very much. Chair, I'm learning some of these names and associations. I think it's helpful when people put down their organization. It helps to manage the hearing. So for future reference, welcome all of you to the committee. Please identify your names for the record before you speak. Maybe you'd like to start.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Van Valkenburg. I'm general counsel for the Oregon Department of Corrections in the AG's office. Apologize for not putting my affiliation down. I was planning to come up with Mr. Zerniak, but we already had counsel, Mr. Williamson from DOJ here, and I didn't want to be redundant. But anyway, I'm here to answer questions for the committee.
Okay. Maybe some of the questions related to Mr. Shelton's line of work, and if you'd identify yourself for the record, I had a question about the timelines for acute medical situations that inmates want dealt with very quickly.
I'm Dr. Steve Shelton. Medical Director for the Department of Corrections, and I actually probably had nothing to do with testifying for this bill, but since I'm here, if you have some questions, I'll do what I can to try and help clarify anything that you'd like. You're asking about timelines for acute medical care. Correct. Well, acute medical care is, I'm going to assume that we're talking actually something that needs to be done. That's dealt with right there, right then, by the physician, by the nursing staff. That clearly is not something which lends itself to a court case in any way, shape, or form, no matter what it takes to get there. Even if you're going to file a habeas case, which is about the fastest court case you can get, you're looking at weeks to weeks to weeks. So first of all, none of what we're talking about here has anything to do with acute medical care.
But
like
let
this
me
person
reframe that. I probably misspoke. I'm talking about the situation where someone has, say, to take the example of hepatitis C, and they believe that they should be getting a certain type of treatment, that they will, their condition will deteriorate if they don't get that treatment in short order.
Okay. First of all, again, hepatitis C is a 20... I'm sorry, Chairman... Chairman Burdick and members of the committee. Couple points of clarification before I get to that. The time course for hepatitis C is 20 to 30 years to run its course. In those people, the 20% of the population who have hepatitis C, for which it's a progressive disease. The other 80% of the population, it is not a progressive disease, and it is far beyond their lifespan that you need to do anything for it because it's not a progressive disease. So when we're talking about hepatitis C, as you say, I'll answer that, but it may not have been exactly an acute disease example because it does have a time frame of 20 to 30 years. Next, at no time was this a point of the class action lawsuit. The class action was brought to question whether or not the treatment guidelines as such fit a state and national community standard for treatment process. It really had nothing to do with individual cases nor timelines for treatment. So let's take a couple other examples of grievances. Would that be
medical
grievances? Can we go there?
Yeah, absolutely.
Again, somehow just got down to medical cases, but I'll talk about some of them because I know some of them. Most of acute medical care is taken care of. DOC has no desire to delay medical care that's necessary to give incompetent care that's going to end up in court anyway. There's no advantage to that. That is not what the grievance process is all about. That is not what the court systems are all about. The grievances we're talking about tend to be things like, you denied me my breast reduction surgery, which we did. We may do that. And we may do that through all three grievance levels for 2 or 3 months. We may, at all levels, deny them breast reduction surgery. They don't like that question, so then they want to take it to court. The current cases, they can take that to court immediately without filing any grievances. If they want two mattresses because the mattress they have isn't thick enough and soft enough for them and they're complaining that they're not sleeping well, they can take that to court immediately without filing any grievances. If they don't like the fact that I haven't single-celled them because they don't like people very well and they get upset when other people are around, they can take that immediately to local county court. Now, they can't take that to federal court, but they can take that directly to county court immediately. If they want a new prosthetic leg, they came in with one, and they've had it for 5 years, and it's kind of worn out from playing basketball, and they'd like to get a new one before they leave in 6 months, they can take that immediately to court. Now, all of these are examples of court cases that have been filed against the Department of Corrections in the county courts. The grievance process runs.
Your witness,
okay.
Excuse me, witness has a question. Sorry.
Okay, Bertie. Doctor, could you apply that same line of reasoning to a West Nile virus infection that has minor progressive central nervous system manifestations?
Chair Bertie, Senator Whitsett, how would that become a grievance?
If the patient was feeling that they were having a minor mental problems, chills, that sort of thing, and they were not being, those symptoms were not being addressed by staff, and they were concerned that they were getting worse, and they might be getting worse, they would manifest themselves as a minor mental disorder, minor mental disease, and yet the patient might be feeling rightfully so that it's progressing, and yet he is unable to get to the, you know, he's unable to get care, and he might be subjected to several months of grievances before he could. That was my point. Thank you.
Chair Boyd, Senator Whitsett, let me then try and progress through that. I think I understand your scenario. Let's just take an unknown something or other that somebody's got, and they see their doctor, and the doctor works them up, does appropriate medical care, per se, sees them, evaluates them, and they don't agree with the doctor's diagnosis. The first and best thing is to go, of course, go back and say, Doc, I think you missed something. Would rather than usually go to court, most people would go back to their doctor and say, I think you missed something. That would be a first, most reasonable, best response. If they then feel that the doctor has not addressed their issue, that would be a time that we would say, it's reasonable to file a grievance. File a question to the supervisor and say, I think the doctor is not paying attention to me. That would then go to the supervisor at that area. That has to be responded to within 15 days. To have them look at that and say, did this doctor pay attention? Did he do something? Is something happening at this local level here? Next response would be, let's say the doctor looks at it and says, yeah, you know, I looked at all this, and the person may think they have West Nile virus, but they really don't. You know, I've already looked for that, and they don't. I know they don't. They think they do.
Let
they
me make an appeal to me. A second.
I'm sorry.
If they go through this process that you're describing, what is the longest? I mean, we heard from Mr. Chuniak that for other non-medical grievances, it's 4.5 months. they go through this process that you're describing, how long does it take to get a resolution of a medical issue?
How long does it take? I think, Senator Burdick, I think what you mean is how long would it take to get a non-resolution?
No, the question was how long does it take to get a resolution to the point that that person could say, this has been through the process, I don't like the result, I'm going to court. What is that time?
Okay. Senator Burdick, I understand exhaustion of remedies. I was thinking of resolution as fixing the problem. And I was thinking, well, you could fix the problem the next day and have a resolution of it.
Okay, whatever.
The exhaustion would be, as in my experience, is 7 days at the first level, 15 days at the next level, and 30 days at the highest level.
So we're talking 42 days. Let's see, 7 days plus how much?
7 plus 15 plus 30.
Okay.
Not counting how long the inmate might sit on it. That's our supervised, that's our DOC response time. Those are the numbers that I've always been held to.
So it's roughly a little under 2 months to resolve it.
Yes, and again, this is of course not...
Not including the response from the inmate. They have a certain amount of time in between those dates.
Well, but that has to go with the time. I mean, it's a process where they file a grievance, then there's a decision, then there's a response from the inmate. That has to be included in the timeline because you don't achieve exhaustion. Am I understanding your question?
I believe the witness is only giving the date or time frame for the department to respond depending on what level they're at as compared to...
Senator Burdick, Senator Pozanski, that's correct. I was saying that my response times and the Department of Corrections are... I get it, I have a week. At the first level, we have 7 days to respond because that's a close level. The second level is 15. The third level is 30 days response. I don't know, because I don't live it, I don't know what the response time or the filing time to follow up on a grievance is on a griever's part for that.
So it would take inmates a certain period of time, at least a couple days, to refile at the next step.
Yeah.
Members of the committee, I interrupt here. There's a whole other avenue of remedy here that no one has spoken to in the medical area, and that has to do with habeas corpus petitions. And in a habeas petition under state law, you may have ability to get counsel appointed under state law, and they can bring a medical claim that they allege requires immediate judicial scrutiny. And it's the fastest type of relief. It's an injunctive remedy, in essence. If the court examines the claim and the records of the department and determines the department should do something different from a medical area, the court can require the department, order the department to do it. It is not a damages remedy. It's merely the state government is ordered to do something differently with respect to that claim. That claim remains open and available to inmates, whether they exhaust or not. That's not an action for damages.
Thank you for that clarification. Senator Pransky, you had a...
Yeah, just for clarification, just on that point. So the habeas means of getting before the court will not be impacted with the passage of Senate Bill 182 on medical claim.
Chair Burdick, Senator Pozanski, members of the committee, that is my understanding. This, when we use the term action, typically that means in law an ability to get damages. That's what I understand the scope of this bill to be. I'd like to hear from Craig Prinz or the task force. I'm not aware of their findings, but that is my understanding, yes. It is also the case that non-medical claims could be brought by inmates in habeas. Again, the distinguishing factor, they cannot seek damages. What we're talking about is exhaustion under these bills before they can seek damages as against the state and the local governments.
Thank you for the clarification. Senator Pesce.
Thank you. Dr. Shelton, I've got a couple of questions for you. I also wanted to, I guess, comment. I saw that you weren't, let's say, real pleased with maybe some of the testimony that you heard that was being given. Normally what we wait for is give you the opportunity to come up and maybe correct the record instead of responding the way I saw you did. So is there some response that you'd like to give and clarification before I ask my questions?
Senator Burdick, Senator Pozanski, I accept your correction.
So I assume you have nothing that you want to correct the record that what you said this morning.
I would like to see. I do believe that Mr. Sugarman represented the comments of Judge Brown. It wasn't a. It was a preliminary statement creating a class action suit, And I have heard him say that several times, and I think that that is a misrepresentation of the actual record. And I stand corrected on my momentary frustration, sir.
That's fine. I'm wondering if maybe we can get the record straight, and maybe if counsel can provide us with whatever documentation there is on that case, so we know.
I can make that available to the committee.
So I appreciate that. So, Dr. Shelton, I guess the one thing, in hearing how the grievances work, especially specifically in the medical area, it sounds to me that if you were the attending physician on a case within the agent or within the Department of Corrections, if that individual chose to, let's say, grieve that as to whatever remedy you did or not provide to them, it's my understanding that your first preference would be for them to talk to you directly on a one-to-one level. But if they choose not to do that and they grieved it to the next level, which I understand may be the therapeutic care committee, is it true that you, as the attending physician, would be allowed to sit in on that review and help make the determination as to whether what you had prescribed to be the treatment would also have a say as to whether that appeal should be upheld, or in the sense of your decision upheld or overruled?
Senator Burdick, Senator Prezanski, other members. The therapeutic level of care committees are regional committees composed of the physicians in the various regions of the state who review cases on an individual one-by-one basis to reach consensus, to reach understanding, to reach the best medical decision, and on the philosophy that 2 to 5 to 10 heads are better than one. They make decisions through consensus and through final democratic decision weighing if consensus cannot be reached. I am one voice. I sit on most of the therapeutic committees, but not all. It is only one of the forms where a grievance appeal could be taken to. At the simplest level, let's take a nurse or a physician interaction. They can either appeal to and say at the physician or the nurse level, go back to them, or they can go to the supervisor of that line staff. That would then be either the health service manager, the chief medical officer of that institution, or the therapeutics and level of care committee, which would be the region of encompassing multiple institutions. It is not the grievance appeal is not really handled by a therapeutic level of care committee. That's a committee of physicians who are making medical decisions about appropriateness of care. A grievance appeal is a response to a displeasure or comment about care. We might say, for instance, gee, let's refer that to a committee and we'll see what multiple doctors may say. They don't actually write a grievance response.
All right, so I take from your answer that one, you would be in many cases sitting on the appeal of a patient that you've either denied, well, I'd say you've denied whatever medical services or claims they've requested. Is that correct?
Senator Burdick, members of the committee, I unfortunately have found that administrative duties keep me from being able to see patients these days. So I would only be involved at above-level review. I'm not the attending physician for any patient at this moment.
Let me ask the question. Are attending physicians also part of the therapeutic care committee?
Yes, they are. Excuse me. Now I understand. Yes, they are. They have the chance to present their case to a committee of physicians, and we have the chance to question them about their findings and their care of that patient. It is a peer review process.
Mm-hmm. That's it for now.
Thank you. More questions? Thank you. We have one more witness signed up, Becky Child, who's signed up against this bill. And I want to move quickly through the rest of this hearing, if we can. So is Ms. Child here? Okay, I don't see her, so we will close the hearing on Senate Bill 182. and open up the hearing on Senate Bill 115 with a very similar cast of characters. Mr. Cherniak, maybe you could start things off for us on Senate Bill 115 after Council reads the summary.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 115 would repeal a statute that is currently on the books requiring the Department of Corrections to provide ongoing medical care to individuals who were former inmates that participated in specific radiation experiments conducted between 1958 and the early 1970s.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, and thank you for also coming to the podium, Mr. Ben Valkenburg. Go ahead.
Okay, Chair Burdick and members of the committee, I am Stan Zerniak, Assistant Director for Operations for the Oregon Department of Corrections, and I'm here to provide information in support of Senate Bill 115, which was introduced by the Governor at the request of the Department to remove obsolete provisions of Oregon law. During the Cold War, more specifically through the latter part of the 50s and into the early 70s, a total of 67 inmates volunteered to participate in a federal government-sponsored hormone and radiation treatment study on inmates at several prisons throughout the nation. Inmates volunteered and were paid for their participation. The experiments in Oregon that received the most attention studied the effects of ionized radiation to the testicles and specific effects on developing sperm. Dr. Carl Heller and others conducted these experiments beginning in 1958 with selection and participation of inmates at the Oregon State Penitentiary. The experiments were discontinued in the early 1970s. Following discontinuation of the so-called Heller experiments, two laws were enacted in Oregon that pertained to the inmates who participated in them. The first law gave these inmates a right to ongoing medical monitoring and follow-up care at the expense of the state even after release. And you can see that in 1987 Oregon Laws, Chapter 486, Section 1. The second law prohibited further medical, psychiatric, or psychological experimentation or research with inmates of the Department of Corrections institutions. And I might point out, too, that the earlier study during that period of time, that was kind of a common practice throughout the country to involve inmates in experimentation of different kinds. Senate Bill 115 would repeal the first law, but not the second. Several years ago, in early 2000, affected inmates filed a class action lawsuit against the state of Oregon seeking to hold the state liable in damages for the actions of state employees who facilitated the inmates' participation in the experiments. The suit was dismissed in 2001 in a settlement in which the state paid a lump sum in excess of $700,000 that was distributed among the inmate participants in exchange for the inmates' release of all claims against the state and individual defendants, and they waived their rights under state law to further state paid compensation or care. As a result of the settlement, the law that grants to Heller experiment participants a right of ongoing medical monitoring and follow-up care is no longer of any legal effect and should be repealed. And I'd be happy to answer any questions that the committee would have.
Two questions right off the top. How many people were in the class, do you know?
Chair Burdick, my understanding is it was 67.
67, and did that include everyone who was affected or known to be affected by that at that time?
Chair Burdick, and I'd like to defer that to Jeff Van Falkenberg. I believe that is the case since it was a class action suit.
There aren't people hanging out there now who have not had some kind of compensation.
Chairman Jeff Van Valkenburg, for the record, that's correct. This was a mandatory class that no one could opt out of. It's a complete settlement of all claims.
Thank you. Did you want to say anything further, or are you here to answer questions?
Unless the committee has any questions,
thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Krasanski?
Jeff, maybe for you, it's my understanding from what I've heard in the testimony that at this point all of those claims that could have been or had been brought through the settlement process have been taken care of, in the sense of the court made some ruling and basically said that any future claims we're basically settled and exhausted any other liability to the state, with the exception of whatever had to be complied with from the settlement itself.
Madam Chair, Senator Przanski, members of the committee, that's largely correct. This was a settlement, and so the court didn't make any finding of liability or any express finding about the manner in which the department had gone about in treating these folks. But contractually, through the settlement, all class participants waived their right under this session law that remains on the books that we're asking to be repealed here today to follow care and treatment in exchange for the lump sum settlement. And my understanding is that I believe there were between 30 and 40 inmates, maybe some more, that have received distribution from that sum.
And it would stand that any, let's say, any issues that may have resulted from the settlement would be a separate dispute that they would file based on, in this case, the state not complying with the settlement agreement.
Madam Chair, Senator Przanski, that's correct. It would be a contractual action if there were concern that the state was had not lived up to its part of the bargain. But, of course, it has, because the lump sum penalty, settlement amount has been paid and distributed.
Is there any reason behind this bill aside from a statutory cleanup? Is there any liability that you see from the state, from this continuing existence of this provision?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think it's largely that, but we still could see an effort by an inmate to bring an action, and this would forestall it. It would save resources in the sense that it would cut it off at the pass, just in case someone might, who's still in the penitentiary. There were some disputes within the class, as I recall, about whether inmates were participants or not. That issue was litigated in the settlement. There could be disgruntled inmates regarding that. So that's a possibility, but the main thing is that the class was mandatory. All relief that could be given was given. Anyone who had rights under the statute have been, those claims have been settled, and there would be no right to proceed. So it is repealing a law that has no essential further effect.
Senator Przanski?
Even if we did go forward and repeal this, it wouldn't stop the inmate from actually bringing an action. You would still rely on the same defense that a settlement had been reached. And so we're not going to necessarily keep the inmate from, let's say, taking that first step of challenging and laying or establishing or attempting to establish a new claim. It would be that I would assume the state would say, well, we've already reached a settlement agreement that took care of all these issues, and so the court should dismiss because there's no merit for the case to go forward.
Madam Chair, Senator Przanski, members of the committee, I think it would be a greater disincentive to an inmate that is disgruntled to even not having the law in the books. That's my point. That, in fact, of course we would raise a defense of the settlement, but if the law is not there for the a disgruntled inmate to cite to, that has in fact been formally repealed by the body, then I think it's a cleaner way to proceed.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair.
Oh, Senator Barr, sorry.
Thank you. And part of the class were inmates who would have been subject to this treatment and that had been released prior to this lawsuit. Were they included in the class?
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, that is my understanding, yes.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. And thank you, Chair Burdick, Senators.
We're going to give Jeff Sugarman the remaining 3.5 minutes of this hearing. Talk fast. Thank you.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Sugarman. I'm with the Western Prison Project. I have had some discussions with Mr. Van Valkenburg and some of our legal folks, and he has agreed to provide me with a copy of that settlement agreement, which we have not had time to look at, and there is some investigating that we'd like to do on this. So if there's any chance of just holding this bill over, we'd like to do some further investigation of this particular bill.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I might add that as a formal term and condition of the settlement, both class counsel for the inmates and the inmates, as a matter of contract, decided to agree to support repeal of this law, and that is in the settlement agreement.
Okay. Senator Przanski, would you be willing to work with these two to get to the bottom of the analysis and maybe report back to the committee?
Yes, ma'am. I'll be glad to.
Thank you very much. Senate Bill 115 is closed. And our longstanding Senate Bill 203 will be deferred to our next meeting. And with that, Senate Judiciary is adjourned.